This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special 100th episode of the DTV Digest. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week is not one, but two co-hosts. We have Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
And Will Bentley.
Hello.
And in this week, in our special episode, we'll be looking at the brand spanking new VFW, more on that shortly, the military thriller Rogue Warfare. Our short shot this week is going to be Kenobi, a fan film based on the Star Wars universe. And our DTV throwback is the 2002 Stallone thriller Detox, also known as ICU. So without further ado, let's crack on. Okay, so our first review is VFW, which stands for Veterans of Foreign Wars. This stars Stephen Lang, among others, William Sadler and Fred Williamson, as local patrons of a VFW bar, who find themselves under siege in a very sort of dystopian 1980s kind of society, when a young girl comes running in having stolen a bunch of drugs from a local street gang. And it turns out that these veterans are rather hardy bunch and not going to sort of lie down lightly even. So, Rich, what did you make of this?
I loved it. It's very much in the vein of John Carpenter movies, like Assault on Precinct 13, and as well as something more contemporary, like From Dusk Till Dawn, in that it's a bunch of characters, not necessarily anti-heroes, basically, under siege from even worse characters. And the cast is led by Stephen Lang, as the owner of the bar. I can't remember what his name is, but he was like the leader of the unit, and they've kind of all stuck together after returning home from their various tours. Very close knit. The great strength of the film is the banter between all of those guys, which include Martin Cove, no less, in one of his best roles in years. He seems to be having a little bit of a resurgence lately with things like Cobra Kai, and even appearing in, was it Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? He had a short appearance in, although,
yeah,
you know, not a big thing, but for fans, you know, would have enjoyed seeing that. George Wendt from Cheers.
Yeah, exactly.
A little nod to Cheers, basically playing a twist on his Norm character as a bar. They're all barflies,
yeah,
basically, at this point in their life. And David Patrick Kelly is also amongst the group. So it's very neon, very bloody, you know, really hardcore, gruesome violence. A little bit dark in places. At times I found it too dark to watch, so I actually had to stop the film and try and watch it on a different TV or a computer and TV and stuff. And it was not working out very well. But luckily, the lighting in the bar, like the Budweiser signs and things, sort of illuminate things a bit more, and it got better from about that point. But about the 25 minutes to 30 minute point where it's really kicking off, I struggled with it, but then luckily it got back on track.
Yeah, so it does sort of mask some of the effects, unfortunately. Maybe that was deliberate, maybe it was just too gruesome. I know one of the guys who comes in basically gets his head stomped into just mashed potato by the end of it.
That was the part of the bit that I just couldn't really see at all what was happening, which was a shame because there's a lot of really good practical work going on there.
Exactly, and I think you sort of kind of know what you're going to expect, what you should be expecting as soon as the Fangoria Presents logo comes up at the beginning. This film certainly takes no prisoners in that regard. Even that first attack where they come running in and sort of David Patrick Kelly's character gets injured straight away, and they just sort of turn on these guys and just make mincemeat of them very quickly. Will, what were your initial thoughts on this?
Yeah, I've got to agree with Rich, actually. The darkness, it may well have been intentional to kind of hide some of the scenes in their special effects.
I've read comments online which suggested that it wasn't our screener that was darker. It does seem to be unfortunately intentional.
Well, I mean, if you work around that and just watch it, I mean, it doesn't ruin it, but it is an impact on your enjoyment of the thing. It definitely was noticeable. The violence, you know, like you say, when it first starts, it's like it is very sudden. It's very gory. Like the shotgun comes out from under the bar
very quickly.
Get the toys out quite fast.
Yeah.
in this bar. I think what I liked about it was that all the kind of banter that the old old Marines and army boys that sat around the bar, all the kind of constant piss taking and banter is just seems very real, very down to earth. Mm. To the point that some of it kind of almost feels unscripted.
It had an improvised feel, didn't it?
Yeah, it kind of seemed like if you know it's all blokes like this, it just sort of it does seem quite real and quite authentic. But the minute that things get into high gear and it kicks off and they realise they're in trouble, they're immediately all business. They're immediately sort of like, and I think it's the main guy, the guy who runs the VFW is Fred, isn't it?
Fred, yeah.
Immediately becomes a top sergeant, like, really quite quickly. But then who's the guy who's basically turned into Private Hudson? It just started
flipping. Oh, well, so that's Martin Cove's
character. Yeah, Martin Cove's character.
Immediately kind of like,
game over, man.
Yeah, no, we're supposed to be in a titty bar.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
Like, they're losing it because they're supposed to be going to some lap dancing club. Mm. And, the horde of enemies outside is basically putting a dent in his evening, so he just flips out. Not the fact that they're in mortal peril. I quite liked it.
No, definitely.
It sets the tone early on with introducing the... Well, it does two things. There's the inciting incident, which is the murder that sort of kicks off, where basically they're showing the effect of the drug, which is so key, and it becomes inside. So there's an addict. She approaches the leader of the gang, the drug dealer, and he just, for whatever reason, he throws the drug down from the bridge or whatever that he's standing on, and he's like, "How much do you want that drug? Go and get it. It's just down there." And she's so far gone that she can't see the logic of plummeting to her doom to try and get a fix. So that's what she does, and that's what the characters in the rest of the film do, because he says, "Right, I want you to go after the girl who took my stash, and if you bring it back, or you bring her back, then you're going to get your fix." So they're just mindless zombies, basically. This is a zombie movie where they're still alive. It's a very clever idea, I think. Yeah. It's called Hype, I think.
That's right. The drug.
It's supposed to be like an opioid, apparently. America's in the midst of an opioid. It says if you read this.
Yeah, there's an introduction.
Which is sort of the big Reagan thing, wasn't it? Sort of saying, the war on drugs and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So it's, very, very, very clever.
It seems Reagan era, doesn't it?
I always enjoy the thing where bad guys just totally underestimate who they're up against. You know what I mean? Always like that, where they come in with a lot of swagger and think they're going to, and then just get their asses handed to them quite early on, and then have to sort of rethink. And this is that whole initial scene when they come in to get the girl, Lizard, and they just get decimated by these old guys straight away. Yeah. And then sort of Steve Lagg's character, Fred, he's sort of going, "Does anyone else want to come in my bar?"
it was really. The structure of the film is quite strange, though, because a slight flaw is they're coming and coming, and then they're not coming anymore, and then they suddenly start coming again, and there doesn't seem any rhyme or reason to why they're not just... It should just be constant, like Dawn of the Dead kind of thing. Yeah, it should just be that they're literally surrounded, and there's no escape, or whatever, but it's like, all of a sudden there's no one outside.
I think they're trying to lure them out, aren't they? They're trying to get into the car, or they get somewhere else, and...
But switching over back to the cast, Fred Williamson is amazing, as he usually is. And how incredible is it that he kind of had this comeback from Dusk Till Dawn in like 1996. And here we are over 20 years later, and he's basically doing exactly the same thing again.
Yeah.
And he still doesn't really look any different.
No.
He's still got the same energy and confidence and, fantastic presence. Even though he's, 83 years old?
I saw him recently in a film called Jackson Bolt, which is a very low-budget sort of police thriller by a guy called Robert Parham. And he got Fred to do some scenes as a sort of police counsellor, and he was brilliant in that. You know, he just really added a lot to that particular film as well. Stephen Lang is an actor who's going to come up a few times today.
Mm-hmm.
I really like him. He's one of those actors. I only discovered him when he was playing the bad guy in Avatar. He was the main sort of bad guy in that.
Yeah.
But since then, he sort of turns up in loads of stuff and loads of stuff previous to that as well. And he's sort of somebody I always enjoy seeing. Another one of his is called Band of the Hand. Have you seen that? Michael Mann.
Yeah, so that's kind of, I think that's one of the films that this is, that would have been a touchstone for this.
Yeah, I think so.
And also, further beyond than that, he was a memorable villain in The Hard Way with Michael Jackson and James Woods. So this episode is sort of an unofficially structured Stephen Lang themed episode.
It's a backdoor Stephen Lang movie.
And as we'll see when we go on to the other films, there's, you know, what a versatile actor he is and how important it is that he has good direction.
So this is a hard sort of horror thriller. It is baked in that sort of purpley blue neon, which is kind of du jour for sort of horror movies at the moment. You've got, you know, films like The Void and Colour Out of Space, which is another one sort of coming out soon.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be the colour scheme for this sort of film at the moment.
And in terms of nodding into action genre, you know, John Wick.
Well, exactly, John, yeah, sort of totally in those sort of colour schemes, yeah.
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 But I love all that. I love that aesthetic.
Yeah, at the moment, yeah. This eventually we'll tire of it and want something new. But at the moment, yeah, it's a good sort of, it's a shortcut to go, they're doing something like John Wick, or they're doing something like, you know, Colour Out of Space or something.
Because even the score is quite synthy, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Which is another great touch.
So, as we mentioned, this is sort of set during the sort of, like, an alternate 80s, thing, you know, they don't have mobile phones. They're watching knackered old VHS tapes.
That's a good point. Saying now, that all makes sense, because I was thinking, if it's set in the future or whatever, why are they watching this old videotape? Yeah. There could be any number of reasons. But if there's like a technological, if the technology hasn't come yet, if this is the 1980s, then that makes total sense.
Yeah. I also like the fact that they make real good use of the young guy who turns up. There's a guy who turns up. Called Sean Mason, who's literally just got off the plane back from Iraq or Afghanistan and sort of stops off at this bar for a drink before going home. And I was really worried because it's the usual sort of like, oh, I've got to get home to my wife and kids sort of thing, I think.
Where's the rest of it?
But he's really good in the film.
Yeah, it's
right. And there's a bit where there's William Sadler and Fred, Stephen Lang's character, sort of stood against like five sort of these street gang members, and all of a sudden they all get shot in the head in like, you know, in like 2 seconds flat. He's like, "Oh, you got a gun with you then?" Yes, sir. But
they're all kind of quite. These are vets from like a war, which, you know, looking at the age of them, they fought kind of 40 years ago. But clearly, they're people to watch because if they survived, it's because they're badasses. And they're very badass in a kind of old guy, you know, loads of experience, cynical, pissed off about life kind of way. But this, you know, Sean is sort of fresh back off the plane. He's like a ranger or something.
Mm.
Everything is like really sort of quick, clean, economical, surgical almost. And he's badass in a very kind of, very sort of different way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He's also the sort of the outsider who comes into the group. So he's that character that's representative of the audience, who they can sort of present themselves to and explain things.
So explain what their background is, because otherwise it's going to be in jokes all the way through, isn't it? So like, you know, their little nicknames and sort of half stories that they, oh, remember when we did this sort of thing? Oh, yeah, you know. Kind of like in Predator, you know, where they're going, oh, remember Venezuela? I'm trying to forget Venezuela, you know, all that sort of stuff.
He does that introductory speech, so he sort of comes over to him and says, you know, I'll tell you about this guy right here. So he did this and that. What kind of man he is.
They're all talking in kind of, you know, GI kind of Vietnam War slang. You know, they're even, you know, people are saying, you know, we better move, Ricky Tick and stuff. And it's all that kind of half English, half Vietnamese slang that guys our age will probably recognise from, well, I'm speaking for myself, really, not you two youngsters, but, you know, you kind of know the stuff from watching the movies. But, yeah, the heel he was for the he was the eyes of the younger generation.
Exactly. Yeah, he's gonna sort of bring in that other crowd. Yeah. So this is getting its like actual premiere at Fright Fest. So that sort of really tells you a lot about sort of how this film is being considered. It's more a horror thriller than a pure thriller, I think. It is very visceral indeed, you know. Sort of like, when you consider that Stephen Lang's weapon of choice is a fire axe, basically, that he deliberately sort of tapes up the handle so it doesn't slip out of his hands and that sort of thing, you know. The way they do the bar, you know, after that first wave, they actually A-teamed the bar.
Yeah, they do. It's totally booby trapped up, really, with
improvised weapons.
Martin Cove gets the hockey stick out and stuff, and I think Fred Williamson has got
nails between his fingers,
and stuff. Yeah. It's an action movie for horror fans.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's going to go down well at Fright Fest. That's for sure.
Anyone who enjoyed the last Rambo film, I think, will enjoy this. In the same vein, although this is a much better film than that film was in its execution, but they're very similar, you know, very horrific kind of movies.
I think this one, the bad guys have got an excuse for running into gunfire and booby traps, in Rambo Last Blood, it's like, at no point do they go, shit, I've just seen 10 guys get mowed down or stabbed to things by things. Do you think we should sort of be a bit more cautious? No, let's just run.
Yeah. I saw you two you were slating that a bit on the social medias.
Well, it was a very valid point that you raised.
It's enjoyable, but, you know, it's just so ridiculous at the same time. They're just mopping up bullets, you know, just bullet sponges with a lot of them.
So what do you think about the villains in this film? So we've got the main guy, and we've also got his henchwoman.
His henchwoman. I do think they're underused. I mean, you know, the main bad guy, we get his credentials quite early on. The fact that, you know, when he lets this woman fall to her death chasing the drug, who happens to be the sister of Lizard, which is why it's the inciting incident. But I thought the woman, his sort of henchman, doesn't really get a lot to do except fight Lizard at the end. Although her death is fucking amazing. Absolutely amazing.
She does get she kills one of their people at the start of the film, which sort of sets the tone for the graphic violence that's going to come. She basically cuts him in half or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was quite nasty. But yeah,
she was a great character, but I'd say I think she could have been in it more.
I think they did get sort of a bit less zombies, more them, you know, maybe. I don't know. But they did seem to be quite small fry, because I think they were sort of trying to set up a drug spy at the same time. So that's why they were pissed off that Lizard nicked their drugs. Mm-hmm. There was sort of a reasonable sort of like low-level sort of threat.
Yeah.
They were living in that kind of warehouse hovel squat full of junkies, weren't they? I mean, it's not. They were hardly enjoying the high life, were they?
Well, in fact, they're actually sort of having to kill off these guys trying to get through the door. It's like, for God's sake, there's like vermin, you know.
They were practically under siege. They themselves do people in to stop them from. Yeah, like
you say. In terms of the drug aspect and the drug action kind of thing, the film that came to mind was the recent Dread with Carl Urban.
Because that
was all about they were all high on slow-mo and he was trying to fight against them and stuff. So that reminded me.
Yeah. Without giving it away, though, which is quite interesting, you know, the whole sort of drug thing and sort of drugs is bad and all the rest of it, the way the film ends, that final scene, where it's kind of like, oh, there's an upside to this.
Yeah, I didn't quite.
It's a totally immoral sort of upside.
Yeah. They're all going, I know what you're saying.
Yeah. Which is really interesting as well. You know, it's a very interesting take on the situation. You know, these guys aren't altruistic. You know, they're living in this sort of world. They have to sort of make ends meet at the end of the day. You know, so yeah. it's a very interesting sort of ending.
Interesting twist.
Yeah. Okay. So, how are we going to score VFW? I'm going to have to jump in straight with an 8, I think.
I concur. I mean, it was entertaining from start. To finish, and it's the kind of film that I really like. And it, apart from that darkness, but that kind of light balancing issue, I think the production was pretty faultless, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to drop it a point
for the darkness
and the ruining of my viewing experience there. So I was going to go 7, but I think I will go 8 in the end.
Cool. So, yeah, this is going to be, as I said, it's getting a cinema premiere, and then it should be straight onto DTV, onto DVD and Blu-ray, hopefully. So look out for VFW. Our second review this week is Rogue Warfare. When an extremist group called the Black Mask starts forcibly recruiting through Syria, a covert team of rogue soldiers, the best of the best from different nations, are put together and given a mission to disrupt the Black Mask's plans. This is going to prove difficult as their supreme leader is highly intelligent and deadly. Now, this is the first part of a trilogy of films, all being directed by Mike Gunter, starring William Lee, who is an actor on the up and up. He was in the TV series Altered Carbon. He's also in Code 8 with the, what's his name from?
Dean Ambrose?
No. The guy from Arrow.
I don't know the
guy from Arrow and his brother. I've forgotten his name now.
But he was also in the 1990s Doctor Who TV movie.
Was he?
Yeah, I believe.
Oh, dear. we won't mention that one.
That's where I know him from, anyway. And Torque, which is one of my favourites. The motorcycle action movie. Yeah.
So TORQUE.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I actually enjoyed this. This isn't big budget stuff. It's pretty low budget, but they do pull off some really good sort of little combat scenes. Where they sort of like stray, at least in this first one, is the putting the team together, which is like really abrupt, and they really do not handle at all the sort of the drama and the narrative that goes with it. What we end up getting is this sort of black British soldier being really sort of like, you're not the boss of me, man. It's kind of attitude, and sort of like wanting to, you know, there's this, it's basically a bunch of alpha males in the room, you know, beating their chests instead of, you know, acting like proper soldiers. And you'd have thought they'd be more interested in knowing how skilled the other people are to protect their backs, sort of thing, rather than sort of like, I'm the most gung-ho person here. So their first mission goes completely tits up, very much like the Strike Back TV series, actually. Section 20's expeditions always ended up in a mess. But, overall, you know, as the film went on and the team started to gel together, I actually sort of really did like this.
Whereas I found it completely tedious and bland. Whereas it might be that I don't like these modern warfare kind of tales, and I've seen this kind of thing quite a lot. So there was a couple of films that it reminded me of. There was one Sidney J. Fury did called American Soldiers, which actually I didn't think it was too bad. But there was Special Forces, which was the French one, with Jimon Hounsou, which I quite liked, although I had some issues with it. But the one it reminded me most of was Sniper Special Ops with Steven Seagal.
No!
Because, in part, I think they shot in the same place.
It could be.
Because it did look exactly the same. So the film starts out really promisingly with some nice aerial photography of whichever Middle Eastern area it's supposed to be. Because I don't think I actually say. And then, actually, the rest of it is all just shot in California. Apart from some aerial sort of establishing shots and stuff, which are either stock footage or whatever it is. The plot just, I just wasn't really that interested. The team is assembled. Okay, they're from various different areas. That's fine. There's the obligatory girl in the team. She's Russian. There's a Chinese agent, a French guy,
Chinese guy, British guy,
American Asian guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it's got an Asian-American in the lead. Mm. You know, this is something we're seeing much more, which is great. William Lee, as we were saying, I've liked him ever since I first saw him in the 90s, so it's nice to see him getting a meatier role. He's not in it as much as I would have liked due to various plot developments. The villain is a big problem for me because he just keeps giving these really long monologues to his friends. Like, it's almost like the film is a propaganda film because it's actually making us listen to him for ages as if we're supposed to come around to his point of view.
And the thing is that he's given these long speeches to his number one lieutenant,
yeah,
who really should be turning around going, Yeah, I know. And almost, you can almost sort of imagine him sort of like repeating stuff back, like talking over him, yeah. You know, as he's sort of saying, you know, like repeating his sentences or saying it at the same time, because
yeah.
He's heard it so many times before. We're like, yeah, we know this.
They go on for ages. He says one thing, he says yes, yeah. Because we were doing this, yes, yeah. Yes, and that's because we've, and then where they will see us and they'll realize that we were doing the right thing all along. And
exactly.
So yeah. We're the righteous ones and stuff. Mm. But there's a really great moment earlier on, probably the best bit in the movie, mm. Where he, because they're kind of sweeping into the local towns and saying, look, you're either with us or you're against us. Mm. And if you're against us,
bang,
bang, like that. And they kill some characters that you would not expect them to kill.
That's right.
So that was mm. quite, that just shows you how ruthless the character is. So I like that. It starts off quite, the whole team being assembled thing was Stephen Lang writing a letter reading it aloud.
Stephen Lang is the president in this, and he's doing his sort of like, you know, who's the actor who played Eisenhower in Pearl Harbor?
I don't know. That was a long time ago.
It was. Can you remember who it was? Just 2 seconds.
But Stephen, just to mention Stephen Lang for a sec, but, you know, we've just seen him in VFW, and he was so impressive in that. In this one, he's such a bland, yeah. Dull presence. He's really just not, and I think it's the fault of the director, just not giving him a character.
Yeah.
Because there's
he has about 3 scenes in the film.
Yeah, he does, yeah. And none of them are really any good.
I know why you're referencing that. Whoever played Eisenhower in that Pearl Harbor film, that was like an ass-kicking performance, made him quite a...
No, it's just, well, yeah, but it's just, Stephen Lang tries to copy his mannerisms, the way he speaks. And I know the actor, I'm going to kick myself when I see the bloody name, John Voight.
So
Stephen Lang's kind of, he's trying to copy sort of John Voight's impression of Eisenhower. This is the way that comes across to me, as this sort of very sort of stately sort of like guy, sort of steeped in the Constitution and stuff, and very, you know, taking his job ultra, ultra seriously. You know, the fact that he's basically signing carte blanche for these guys to go murder anyone they feel like it in the course of justice in the American way. There are issues with this film. I cannot deny that.
Well, there's lots of cliches. I mean, he even at one point says it's way too quiet.
Oh, God.
He says, I got a bad feeling about this.
There's all that. And
that's like literally by the numbers.
For me, the worst bit actually of that was William Lee's character trying to save, because one of them gets stabbed, and he's trying to save him. And it's all the usual, like, stay with me, don't you die on me, all this sort of stuff. And it's like, oh, for God's sake, you know.
Apply pressure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we saw that film, The Veteran, ages ago.
Keep the calm, apply pressure.
Yeah, exactly. It would be that sort of situation, wouldn't it? It's like, it's very sort of matter of fact, we do this and do that. And you're like, hand me this.
Are you talking about the Toby Kebbell one?
Yeah.
That was brilliant. The way when he patches him up and then just does one. Just leaves him going, just what? You all right? Yeah. And then just goes.
Yeah. Not all this, stay with me. Yeah. Oh, God, we're going to save him.
No, just as a field dress, he gives him some water, makes sure he's okay,
yeah,
and then just F's off.
There's even and in terms of the cliches, we even get a countdown with a bomb and a wire cut.
Seriously?
It's like the same scene you've seen a billion times.
I get the impression.
It makes it funny. Yeah. I mean, those cliches, for me, were the sort of the bright spots, because I could just laugh with it, but the rest of it was just taking itself so seriously. And the fact that it ends with no conclusion, and just the team will return.
If they can secure funding.
This has all been made.
That's the interesting thing, is they've made a trilogy all at once.
Yeah.
So they're releasing them monthly. So by the time this is out, the second, possibly even the third, will be out.
Yeah.
Because they're releasing them as if it's almost like a TV series. So it's a very interesting thing. Never happens, does it?
Maybe that's why you got such... I've not seen it, speaking from the point of view of someone who's just watched the trailer and thought it looked quite interesting. Maybe that's why he gets so much dry exposition from the main bad guy, because they need him to be convincing of you to believe that he's actually a serious bad guy, if he's supposed to last a 3-film story arc or not. Yeah. I don't know, because I've not seen it.
Well, possibly. The problem is, he's just dull, and you don't listen. You start to drone out of what he's saying, and you're just waiting for the next scene to start. It's like, get on with it. Why is this film not progressing? Okay, where do we keep returning to this guy? It feels like padding.
Okay, so this is directed by a guy called Mike Gunter,
He's a second unit and stunt director. I think he worked on like Transformers. Exactly.
So I get the impression this is a passion project for him.
I think so.
You know, he's, as you said, he's done some second unit directing before. He's done a lot of stunt work before, sort of across films and TV. But this is his, I think this is his first sort of directorial
I
can see promise in this, and I think now they have managed to establish the team a bit better, and they don't need to go through all that rubbish again. I'm expecting the next bit to actually improve. You know, I think there's potential here for growth. So I for one, I'm interested in the next film.
Okay, well maybe let's try that, and we'll see. We'll come back and we'll see where we stand after part two.
I'm going to give this one a 6 out of 10.
I'm going to give it a 4 out of 10.
Ooh, bit of disparity there, but yeah, okay. So a 6 and a 4 for Rogue Warfare. This is the first part of 3, which will be coming out over the next few months.
Is it worth me spending my time watching this?
I think so, yes.
I obviously don't.
Our short shot this week is Kenobi, a Star Wars fan film about, you've guessed it, Obi-Wan Kenobi. So this is set round about when Luke Skywalker was about 5 years old. Kenobi, Ben as he's known locally, is living in the Tatooine Outlands. But he just can't help himself. He keeps getting spotted by Uncle Owen. And they have a bit of a confab. And then one day, what are they called?
The Empire?
The Empire, yeah. Some Imperial... I just went blank for a minute. I was thinking the Federation.
Representatives of the Empire.
Yes. So one day, the Empire finally turns up to do a census, in inverted commas, and things kick off. Well, this was quite a decent-looking, sort of X-laden little film for a fan movie.
Yeah, it really... I mean, to be honest with you, it could have seamlessly been kind of, you know, drawn out and turned into like a, you know, a Netflix series. It was easily, the production values were easily that good. Someone has spent a great deal of money making all of the costumes look absolutely spot on. And not just sort of convincing, but they were absolutely right for that period in the canon.
Yeah.
Like for early Star Wars movies, what Owen and Beru were wearing, was absolutely right. And
as well as the things like the droids and the location.
The droids and the location, perfect. But I suppose, I mean, it kind of helps if you've got access to sort of endless desert if you live in the States. I mean, I think you'd struggle to make it in the UK.
But that was Morocco.
No, where?
They went to Morocco.
Morocco, wow. Not Tunisia. Oh, no.
Well, yeah. No, because they shot part of Return of the Jedi in Tunisia, but they shot part of... They also shot part of that in Nevada, didn't they? Or Yuma? No, Arizona.
But that's where they were... That's where they went for this particular film. So all those, we get these big sweeping shots of the characters in this land. So we see the characters there. We know it's not stock footage.
Yeah, it's not green screened or anything.
Yeah,
wasn't it A New Hope shot there? Was it maybe it was the same?
Tunisia was the first one. So this one is Morocco doubling for the Tunisian location, basically.
I think Tunisia is a bit of a dodgy spot at the moment.
Maybe you don't want to be hanging around there. I think they have some troubles. But it looked right. Not only that, the first thing I noticed watching it, which I think you noticed as well, was that they got Obi-Wan's voice.
Mm.
Whoever did that, it sounded like somewhere between Alec Guinness and Ewan McGregor. So it was just brilliant. I thought
Jamie Costas, I think.
Yeah. Was the name. So he's sort of, you can imagine sort of Ewan McGregor sort of growing towards the sort of Alec Guinness sort of voice. And this is sort of somewhere in between.
It's brilliant.
So it was very well done. If you think that Luke was meant to be sort of about 18 in A New Hope, then in this one he's about 5. So it's probably 13 years in between.
Yeah.
But it was really good. Even the edits, you know, the way it sort of wipes across the screen, you know, is exactly
titles were exactly the same as in
exactly.
New Hope.
Exactly. All done very well. And there's some nice sort of shortcuts. You know, where they did get quite ambitious with the production, for example, having a speeder bike and the you know, the land speeder. It's like, oh no, we can't move it because he's using his Jedi mind forces to it's stuck there. You know,
although a friend of mine I showed this to said actually that was for Endor or something. That wasn't something they used on.
It's probably no, they didn't use it in you're right in the in a new.
But again, it's probably what they had access to. I presume, and they just incorporated it.
Well, probably. I don't know. Would it have worked in the desert? You've got sort of sand in the engine intake or something. It's possible because they did use those. What were they called? Those big lizards.
Yeah.
Dewbacks.
There we go.
See? Well,
you were quite
wet.
Yeah. You might have to edit this entire section.
Yes, so they used dewbacks in A New Hope. Even more so in the special edition version. But yeah, no, this is a really good sort of like little sort of encounter between some stormtroopers and sort of, you know, the farmhands. So it does sort of work with, you know, Obi-Wan sort of using his Jedi powers and, you know, exposing Luke to this, you know, even at a lot young age. So, yeah, it was really, really well done.
To touch on the plot, the story finds Ben Kenobi kind of at a distance from the Force. He's not actually feeling... He's not feeling it at the moment.
He's not feeling the force at the moment.
At the beginning, he's kind of had enough.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a bit where he's kind of, you know, he wants to get rid of his lightsaber that he's got, and then he kind of has to get it back. And I think the story covers quite a lot of ground in what the is. I mean, it's a 15-minute film with about 4 minutes of credits on it, and because of the sheer amount of people that were involved, it was a crowdfunded production, I believe. So that's where they got the huge budget that they clearly had to be able to go and shoot internationally and get some really good actors on board, as well as, you know, the technical people who've made it look, as far as I'm concerned, like canon.
It just
looks so good. If they didn't put intentionally so the title of the film Kenobi, a Star Wars fan film, which they've actually put on the film itself for probably obvious reasons, you would not be unfairly mistaken. There's lots of lens flare, so there's like nods to the current J.J. Abrams era. We get a Wilhelm scream in the sound effects, which I love, because pretty much every single episode we record, something we watch has got a Wilhelm scream in it. And the tension just builds really well with Ben Kenobi and that struggle that he's having and him trying to watch over Luke and keep him safe and make sure that the Empire never knows that he's there, which has a great payoff at the end. There's some dust in the eyes kind of stuff, which is a bit not convoluted, but a bit convenient because it kind of happens at a key point and they work on it really well, but then like straight after... He's absolutely fine. He's good. Owen Lars, the actor who played Owen Lars, was my favourite in the movie. He just looked such the part.
A great
character, great actor. You know, great costume and everything. More so than some of the others in the small cast, I think he looked like he was the real deal, and you could see him in one of the other films. I loved all the droids and everything. So can't praise this film enough. This came out Christmas. Time, so it's quite new and still waiting there to be discovered. So check it out on YouTube.
Yeah, so we'll put a link in the footnotes to where you can find this. Go check it out. 18 minutes, 15 minutes of your day. You know, watch it during your lunch hour. Perfect. Our DTV throwback this week is Detox, also known as ICU. This stars Sylvester Stallone as an FBI agent on the trail of a serial killer who is going around killing police officers and getting nowhere fast. After the serial killer strikes very close to him, it sends him into a spiral of depression, forcing his captain to send him off to a detox centre, which is situated in an old bunker in the middle of some icy, nightmarish wasteland place run by Chris Christopherson. There he meets a bunch of other cops on the edge and slowly but surely starts to realise that something is amiss. Now, Will, we watched the trailer for this a few minutes ago because you haven't actually seen the film. What sort of impression did you get from the trailer?
I got one of a completely different film to the one that you just described. it looked like it would have been a fairly interesting film, but there was so much stuff in it which, I mean, obviously you and Rich were both watching this and kind of wincing and smirking a little bit at just how, like, widely off the mark they were. But it comes over as, it doesn't just come over as like an action movie as opposed to a building psychological kind of, you know, mouse hunt. But basic major plot points are misrepresented so massively that, you know, I was quite surprised. You would be surprised. Any of our listeners who watch that trailer now would probably be quite surprised by what they
see. Absolutely, yeah. I think it definitely sort of missells what the film is about.
And I think that speaks to the trouble that the film got itself into, because it was made in 1999 but sat on a shelf for two, ultimately 3 years, because I think the distributors, or Universal, I think, who made it, didn't know what to do with it. I think they weren't sure whether they could sell it as a horror movie, thriller, so they were trying to repackage it as a typical Stallone action kind of fest.
Well, I think that's part of the problem as well, is because at the time, Stallone was sort of, he was at a bit of a sort of low point in his career. The films sort of before and after this were things like
Get Carter,
Driven. And Driven, which again never got to the cinema in the UK.
It did.
Did it?
Yeah, I saw it in the cinema.
All right, okay. I didn't think.
But Get Carter didn't.
Yeah.
And Avenging Angelo didn't.
Yeah. So, you know, much in the same way that Clint Eastwood hit a sort of point when he was doing things like Pink Cadillac and The Rookie, you know, where sort of the studios might have considered him, okay, you're slipping into that sort of DTV area now. You know, that's where Stallone was really with this one. I think it probably wasn't sort of his particular sort of level was, you know, coming down a bit at the time. So yeah, I can see why they might have sort of lost a bit of faith in a Stallone driven sort of vehicle.
Well, what they've done is they've taken an Agatha Christie formula and they've put in Sylvester Stallone as the, not quite as the Miss Marple or Hercule Poirot character, because he doesn't really fulfil that function. He's kind of useless until the end. He's very much sidelined. He's among the group, but he doesn't really have it figured out until the end. And that's what's kind of one of the interesting aspects of the film, is it starts very much like a Seven ripoff with the opening credits montage of newspaper clippings and things, and establishing there's a serial killer of cops, and Stallone as Jake Malloy is the lead Federal Bureau FBI investigator, and so the killer automatically sort of takes a particular interest in him, which has poor consequences for his family and sends him over the edge, and is what leads him to the detox center reluctantly, it should be said, taken there by his colleague played by Charles S. Dutton. And that's where he meets up with a whole bunch of other very troubled souls, cops, including
Robert Patrick.
We've got Robert Patrick looking, very trim.
Indeed. You know, that's one way of putting it.
Yeah, very whippet-like, more so than you've ever seen him in anything else. I mean, he must have put a lot of work in the gym before he did this film. And he really does get a good performance as well in it. As a very nasty character, should be said. Tom Berenger and Robert Prosky lending a solid support, although perhaps underused. Very, very well regarded character. Chris Christopherson's really good. There's so many actors in here that are really great that they don't actually get a lot to
Stephen Lang, to do. Our golden thread between all films this week.
Well, interestingly, Stephen Lang is in his character, going back to what we were saying before. His character in this is very small, but he does a lot with it. He's only in a handful of scenes, but he makes it his own, and he's a very memorable figure. But we've also got Sean Patrick Flannery as part of the group, and he basically all the amongst the group, one by one, they start to die, and this is believed at first to be suicides. Now the first one is Sean Patrick Flannery, who would do another film with Stephen Lang, many years later, when he starred in Beyond Valkyrie,
all right,
with Rutger Hauer, and directed by Claudio Fay.
Ah,
so that's that was only released digitally over here. I do want to see it. Yeah, I think it was in the line of like in the Company of Heroes and stuff. Okay. I think that kind of thing. So the we've got Jeffrey Wright, who's well known as Felix Leiter in the new Bond film series, and he's a great character. He's all messed up from where he's tried to eat a bullet, and he's all jittery and stuff. Great character performance. As we mentioned, Charles S. Dutton. Loads of great people, but to such an extent that Stallone basically gets sidelined between the beginning and the end of the movie. He's kind of on the periphery, sort of observing what's happening, not even really investigating.
No.
Circumstance leads him to discover what's going on, but
I think that's
only at the end.
I think there is an issue with the pacing in this film because the opening sequences are done at a breakneck pace, and done really, really well. It's almost like a whole episode of Criminal Minds sort of truncated into the first sort of 15-20 minutes.
And also like a Saw film more recently. I think there's notable comparisons between the setup of this film and the concept of the new Saw film. But even if you remember, if anybody saw like Jigsaw recently, just sort of that initial setup and pace that they develop with establishing, here's the person in peril, here's the killer on the telephone, whatever, even like Scream and stuff did all that sort of stuff. But in those cases, there was a cops involved. There's a pace and a rhythm and a speed, and then it changes into a different film, doesn't it?
Exactly. It becomes something completely different, and we're back to setting things up again. So we've got a whole new bunch of characters to be introduced, and to sort of throw suspicion at the audience, basically. So little ticks and things, and sort of like weird glances every now and again to sort of put us on the wrong foot. And then eventually, the characters have to sort of cotton on to the fact that there's something not quite right here. So people are dying all over the place, So it takes a while to sort of pick up speed again.
The film does a lot of cutaways throughout the story to Charles S. Dutton's character, which are really inconsequential. Apart from showing us that he's still around, they don't really serve any other function. The fact that he's sort of putting things together himself. Mm. He arguably does more detective work than Jake Malloy does in the Detox Centre.
Yeah. So Stallone, sort of, basically, he's just like, in sort of James Bond parlance, he is the blunt weapon, isn't he, basically? He's just like a blunt instrument, sort of just bounce, literally at times, just bouncing off the walls and running down corridors. He's chasing cars, basically, is what he's doing. It's like a dog chasing cars. Wildly around, he basically stumbles upon what's actually going on through sort of convoluted circumstances. But Charles S. Dutton's character, those cutaways are basically just to keep reminding the audience that there is some authority out there, or some form of benevolent force out there which can come to the rescue. Yeah, otherwise it's like all these people just sort of stuck in one location with no way out, and
It also kind of guides you to where it's going. You know that eventually there is going to be convergence.
Yes.
It's just, when is that convergence going to happen?
True. Yeah.
How do you feel about the end of the movie and the reveal of the killer and how that situation is dealt with?
Well, I think the killer was, for me, it was reasonably obvious for long periods, quite early on. I sort of conned on who it was most likely to be. But, I do like the sort of death scene at the end, even though it's almost like something out of The Simpsons. And the problem is, as well, is that, the name Malloy, I can't help but think of, like, Sam Neill's character when he was in The Simpsons, who played sort of Grandpa Simpson's roommate, who's the cat burglar. But anyway, that's beside the point. Every time I hear the word Malloy, I just hear Grandpa Simpson's going, "His name is Malloy, and he lives in my retirement home." But I like the fact that he had to be killed twice.
Villain always has to die twice, don't they?
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
you have to shoot him and then throw him off a building or anything like that, don't they?
Mm, God, wait until we get onto the sweeper. Anyway. Any final thoughts?
Final thoughts were, I just thought it was a bit funny that the concept of the film was that the killer that Stallone's character has been hunting sort of ends up hunting him and sort of tracking him down. And the film kind of asks, Malloy says to the killer, "How did you find me?" Basically, and he just says, having given quite a detailed explanation of other aspects, he just says, "That doesn't matter."
Yeah.
It's like, because it's like shorthand for like talking to the audience, saying, "Don't think about it too much." Let's just move on. Yeah. Let's just move to the conclusion.
You might as well say, "Why didn't he kill me earlier when I was sort of like, you know, in a fit of depression for the last 3 months, drinking myself to death?"
Yeah.
You know, he could have easily picked me off at any time.
I also think the double ending, the two attempts to kill the villain. I think the second one seems like it might have been a reshoot decision.
Hmm.
Because they might have said, "Oh, that's not satisfactory enough. Let's have him lifted up, clearly on wires, and for like a big superhero kind of moment."
It is. It's a bit like WWE to a certain degree as well. But I think also the fact that when he's killed, you know, when he's thrown onto this threshing machine the first time, he is sort of in a sort of like crucified pose. So it's almost like be martyred, I guess, to a certain degree. Something we thought, no, we don't want him to go out like that. You know, it looks a bit too, you know, as if we just killed the good guy, sort of thing. Yeah. This is directed by Jim Gillespie, who was, as we were talking earlier, Rich, he was very prominent at the time. He directed I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yeah.
I saw a film of his from 2016 called Takedown, which is also known as Billionaire's Ransom, which I really liked.
Which I think is on Netflix.
I think it is, yeah. It's one for a future episode, that's for sure. It's pretty decent. And that's the end of this episode. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Will and Rich for joining me.
No problem.
It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. And yes, we'll put the links to the trailers in the footnotes, as well as the link to the Kenobi short. Do check it out. 15 minutes of your time. You can fit it into your lunch hour. We know you can. So thank you very much, and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments, and tune in again next time.